Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us, those in the hall and most of us who are in the virtual hall this morning. Hopefully with the vaccines that are becoming slowly but inexorably available, hopefully the time is not too far distant when we can be back together again in the flesh. As many of you know, this January we are sort of doing two things. One is we are kind of slowing down our offering of programs, retreats, intensives, etc., just to give people a chance to incorporate, review all the Dharma that's people have been exposed to, involved in the past year. So that's one focus of this month, and the other focus is the sort of more deliberately bringing in kind of our New Year's, beginning new aspirations into our life in a way that they just don't join the list of other past ones that we forget about, but that actually we can incorporate in our life to do that. And because of that orientation in terms of one, the things that people are letting go of, from the past and the people that people want to cultivate in the future. I've had some interesting conversations with members in my interviews with them or in groups, as well as hearing from people who are mentoring about some of the issues that people are dealing with, whether these are newer people or more longer-term people. And they have to do with we might call them patterns of consumption and pleasure. So I thought the title for this talk could be Drug, Sex, and Rock and Roll. And it was very interesting to me that when sort of people brought up these issues, I thought, isn't this interesting that no one really ever asked me about these things that are so kind of essential to the human experience and especially to the American cultural experience at all ages. So I don't know what that's about. I mean, people ask me all kinds of things about all kinds of issues in their personal life, interpersonal life, but somehow, I don't know, I hope it's not me, that for some reason people don't ask me that. So I'm gonna jump right in and talk about it anyhow. It's funny, when the phrase drug, sex, and rock and roll came to me, it reminded me of my many years as a therapist, when often I'd either be dealing with kids, but more appropriately with their families. And you know, and many of them, let's say, had kids, teenagers, who had sort of, you know, lost all interest in school or sports or other kinds of things. Because they had discovered another life, drug, sex, and rock and roll. And I used to say to the parents, yeah, this, you know, this is not easy, you know, compared to doing your homework and going to school. You know, a life of pleasure and enjoyment and having fun, especially for minds that do not think about the future or really have no more meaningful, it's very difficult to compete with a life that is oriented toward pleasure and fun. The interesting thing is, you know, many people do grow out of that. Let's say, and sort of get, you know, a little more serious about life in terms of you know, fulfilling other adult milestones, you know, creating meaningful relationships, finding meaningful work, et cetera, and sort of give up their pleasure-seeking ways. Some don't, and many of us may know people or maybe some of those who didn't do that. But what was interesting to me, I think, is that many of people who have kind of gone on and become you know, undertaken, you know, more adult ways, in their hearts, they still live for pleasure and fun. Right? They still look forward to the weekends, so they can have pleasure and fun. And the interesting thing in our culture is, and I'm talking about our American worldly culture. When I say worldly culture, I mean the culture of the world, not necessarily culture of people who are practicing a spiritual path, is that the involvement or the normality of ongoing, consistent use of substances is pervasive and, for many people, most people, normal. As well as in terms of sexuality, sexuality is highly overt in our culture. It is a major topic of conversation. It is a source of all kinds of conflicts. It seems to be pervasive, especially in youth culture. But even adult culture, we know that the major use of the internet people use is for consuming pornography. And we know that, I remember when I was a counselor, I'd find over the years that more and more marital discord often was around sexual issues, sources of conflict. So this is very interesting. And, for me, it's how do you approach this issue without, sounding like a what? Somebody, imposing kind of standards on people, or sounding too much like, I don't want to use names, but you know what I'm talking about, So I think the challenge is, how do you look at these things which are so normal in our society, but from a point of view of someone who is pursuing a spiritual path, which makes everything different. Someone who is approaching a spiritual path, somebody who's living by the Dharma path, is living life and looking at life in a very different way than ordinary people do. In the same way, it's true for us. In our changes, we look at patterns of behavior that might have been very normal for us, right? But now we look at it differently. So I think you could put a lot of this, sexuality, drug, alcohol use, and these days there are many other things that the people pursue for pleasure, food. Exercise. I mean, we could go on and on. I won't go on and on. I'll stick to the main topics. The pursuit of pleasure. What is wrong with the pursuit of pleasure? Or let us say, what is wrong with pleasure? Well, there's nothing wrong with pleasure. There's nothing wrong with pleasurable experiences. They are part of life, we might say. We have senses, and when our senses meet with a positive experience, we feel pleasure. In the same way, when our senses meet with a unpleasant experience, a negative experience, we don't feel pleasure, or we feel the opposite of pleasure. So this is the normal part of human experience, you see. So why in the precepts and the training of Buddhism are there specific trainings, fundamentally about sexuality and about the use of intoxicants? And I think before we can look at this, we need to see the bigger picture, and this is, again, because if we go case by case or situation by situation, we can go, well, I do this and this and this, but I don't, this doesn't affect me deeply, or this doesn't make me a bad person, or this doesn't, you know, doesn't have all kinds of negative consequences. And that may or may not be true, but let us look at, look at what that means. So there is pleasure in life. Sexuality is a sexual contact can be very pleasurable. It's a pleasurable experience. For many people, having a drink of wine or beer or smoking this, and I guess nowadays people eat, they're called edibles. So these are experiences that make life pleasurable, or perhaps make life more pleasurable for people. And we can't, I wouldn't disagree with that. These are pleasurable experiences. I think the problem from a practitioner point of view is what happens when they are no longer just, random pleasurable experiences among a myriad of potential pleasurable experiences that human beings can have, and become more so. In Buddhism, we call that thirsting, tanha, thirsting for, grasping at, attaching to. You see, when anything begins to enter that frame of mental emphasis in our minds, it is considered potentially negative, because the experience of wanting and needing and thirsting for and grasping at and attaching to is agitating to the well-being of the mind. And in our tradition, there is this fundamental stance that the mind in its natural state is fine. The mind relaxed and aware, just present to whatever, is basically having a positive experience, whatever it is. Just being here is pleasurable. Just being present to life and people and nature is pleasurable. Just eating food is pleasurable. There's lots of just very natural, pleasurable experiences. So we have to ask ourselves, why isn't that enough, you see? So what I want to share with you is a process of reflecting on what's going on, you see. And that involves mindfulness, being mindful of, learning to be present to. In my talks with people last week, and some of them are sort of new to the practice, and some have been practicing for decades, who still talk about their use, and what's it about, you see? Are we willing to stop and get out of all the rationalities we have and say, well, what's it about? Why do I do that? You see, why do I have a glass of wine while I'm preparing dinner and then another glass of wine with dinner or a beer? Do we really ask ourselves, what's that about, you see? And for people that, many people say, I enjoy it, But that's, I think, not the truth, you see. Because why can't one just enjoy just preparing dinner? It's a very sensual experience, right? Why do we need something else, you see? Somebody else told me, it's social, you see. When I get myself a little high, I'm more relaxed. I can be more engaged with people, you see. So we see that there's a reason that we're doing it. Or somebody else who I was talking to this week, who has a more significant problem, said, you know, I do it because when the activity of my life stops and there's a gap, you know, like work's over or something's over, I don't feel good. Or the stuff that I don't want to feel begins to come up, you see. So therefore, I take a drink or I smoke this or that, and then it all goes away. So I think it behooves us, as we enter this new year, you know, this is not about bad, you see. This is not, this stuff is bad. Intrinsically, you know, it's not bad. But we have to look deeply if we want to be free and go, because again, Zen practice, great perfection practice, points us in another direction. It says, we are already inherently perfect. We don't need anything to be happy, Thich Nhat Hanh says. We don't need anything to be happy. We practice meditation. One of the things we learn in meditation is that we can relax our body and mind. I don't have to take a substance to relax my body and mind to be relaxed. I can learn how to do that myself. I can learn how to engage with people. I think when I've given talks in the past, I've pointed out it's always seems very strange to me. I mean, looking back, you know, on growing up and all those decades, is that when you socially go to somebody's house for some kind of activity, the first thing they say to you when you're not even in the house, when they say to you, what do you want to drink? Which is very interesting. You see, I mean, like you're not even in the house. It's like, you know, let's get, to be with each other, we got to get a little buzzed, you know? I mean, it's like the idea that somehow I could just come in the house and just be with you, have dinner with you, socialize with you, and I don't need anything to drink. You know what I mean? It's like no one ever stops to go, what's going on? I mean, you know, am I such a terrible person that, you know, you need a drink to deal with me? Or you think, you know what I mean? You know, you're concerned about how things are going, so you want to, you want to give me a drink because, or you need a drink. Do you see what I'm saying? If we stop and think about it, what's that about? And again, it's so pervasive. It is so normal, right? We don't even notice it. Like, what's that about? But Buddhist practice is about looking deeply. It's about stopping and looking deeply. And again, it's not that one's use of alcohol or drugs is necessarily doing you harm, but it may be getting in the way of your spiritual development, which is this capacity to know that you have the ability to be happy. You have the ability to be at ease. And you do not need a substance to make that happen. And by continually using substances to make it happen, you are then not having the ability to know that truth for yourself. So I think this, for me, is getting at the heart of it, you see, is the way we look at, you know, all kinds of our behaviors. And many of us, in terms of our practice, we look at our behaviors. We look at our actions of body, speech, and mind because we want to cultivate those that create wholesomeness, goodness, that support transformation. And we want to stop doing those that either are sabotaging or injurious of that, or else are just taking up our time, you see. And so we are not available. Our mind, our energy is not available for doing activities that are truly transformative. Right? So this is not, you know, being a teetotaler. Isn't that the frame of a teetotaler? You know, this is coming to a conclusion about our life and the way we live our life that is comes from introspection, comes from reflection. Now, one of the things that I've learned, and again, I want to open this up because I really hope to have a good discussion with everybody today and be able to respond to you. You know, the foundation of the Buddhist precepts is to do no harm. Right? To do no harm to oneself, to do no harm to another's. You know, I think sexuality is very interesting because I think it's something in our culture that, again, is basically a pleasurable experience, but that does a lot of harm. Does a lot of harm to both people. How can a pleasurable experience do harm? Because it's not about the pleasurable experience. It's about all the things, the grasping, the needing, the wanting. You know, I mean, in one of the trainings, Thich Nhat Hanh writes, you know, sexual expression is not love. If you want love, you're not going to find it in sex. Now, it doesn't mean that among people who care and love each other, that sexual expression can't be a good part of a relationship, you see. But it's not the same as. And we know that many people, you know, who are looking for love, looking for connection, you know, looking to be with another human being, you know, it becomes all about a sexual encounter, which leaves you what? Often not feeling good afterwards. You know, the other interesting thing about pleasure, and this is kind of fundamental, and this is one where the Buddha warned people about pleasure seeking. The problem with pleasure, it has diminishing returns, you see. It's built into it, which is physiological almost. It has diminishing returns. That's why, you know, people want to prolong it. People want to have it more often, right? Because why is that? Because the experience itself is temporary. And actually, the more you do it, it works less and less. See, it's interesting. It's actually the opposite. It's actually the less you do it, when you then do it, it'll be more pleasurable. It's very interesting. But we have a culture which goes the other way. Right, and therefore you can see why abuse, addiction, all this stuff is so normative in our society. Because we don't have intelligence, even in relationship to pleasure, because it's also accessible. And yet, isn't it interesting, right, that it's normative, and they're not aware of there is another side. There is a dark side of all this, you know. And that was one of the meaningful things in my encounter with Thich Nhat Hanh, because traditionally the Buddhist precepts about do no harm and are more about an individual making a vow, making a commitment for oneself. But Thich Nhat Hanh really opened up the whole idea of kind of society. Somehow I am more aware of my consumption patterns, not just for me, not just for the harm or it does to me, but also because there are many people in our society that it does harm to. And in my actions of body, speech, and mind, I don't want to support that. I don't want to be an exemplar of that. I don't want to be a model of that. Because I may be I may be somebody who goes, yeah, I can have a glass of wine and not have another one. But there may be somebody that I'm offering it to or drinking with who it's a problem to them. They may not be able to stop at one, right? Or it may be in their life in a way that is very destructive. So am I aware that just by my involvement in that is supporting, you know, harmful behaviors that are harmful for other people, for society? And so we often, you know, that's a, like a whole nother dimension. That's sort of the way bodhisattvas think. You see, it's not just about me. It's about how I want to show up in society, how I want to, you know, I mean, you know, I have family, I have children, I have nieces and nephews, you know, that I'm involved with, right? You know, I'm sort of an odd duck. That's okay. But, you know, I feel I want to show them that I can be with them and I don't need any substances. I can be happy, I can be conversant, I can, you know, enjoy everything they're enjoying, but I don't need a substance in me to do that. So I'm very aware that it's not just a personal choice for me, that I'm really not interested in that. Because actually, I feel it often dulls my mind. It's funny, in the traditional Zen formulation of the precepts of intoxicants, it says to keep, you know, don't use intoxicants because you want to keep the mind clear and open at all times. I want to cultivate, that's the kind of mind I want to cultivate. Now, for many people, they don't want to cultivate that mind. You know, that's the unfortunate thing. They don't know the clarity and openness and spaciousness of the natural mind. You know, their mind is not like that at all. It's tight and constricted and often painful. So, you know, the idea of just being with themselves is something that is not very palatable. I understand that. But again, we want, as practitioners, to first, find that other way within ourselves, and then be able to manifest that to others. You know, let me stop now. I mean, I could say more, but I'd rather hear your questions. And please, you know, feel free to ask whatever you want. I think this is very important, not just for ourselves, but as individuals, but as members of families, members of societies, friends, colleagues. I mean, this is as I said, I was just very interested these last couple of weeks that I had these various conversations, and I realized, isn't that interesting? Nobody ever talks to me about this. And yet it's obviously very central for many people. And if it's not for us, it could be for our children, or it could be for our relatives, or it could be for our friends, or colleagues. So please, on the bottom of your screen, you have a chat button. And please, could you just chat in your question, take a time, and that's fine. And if you want to challenge me, that's fine. I mean, I'm not imposing Buddhist commandments. Some people do it that way. You know, I think it's more important that we use our own powers of self-reflection without attachment to our views, to really reflect, you know, on our behavior, the behavior of others in this way.
Fred, the first question is, addiction is a physical experience. The addicted body has a compulsion to use because it's seeking relief from pain, not pleasure. Once addicted, you don't feel like not using is a choice.
Well, again, I understand, having worked in the field, I understand the physiology of addiction, but having worked over the years with many, 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 many people who get high, which often is the entranceway to addiction, it is the seeking of pleasure, pleasure as a state that is not painful. So, I would say, yes, you're right. It is getting away from pain, but it is seeking pleasure. And most people don't wake up one day and become an addict. There is a process they go through. There are what they call entry drugs, entry experiences. And they are pleasure seeking. Now often, right, it is to get away from their pain. But if we don't acknowledge that when they get high, the pain for a period of time appears to cease, or even they have a pleasurable experience, which many of them do, right? Again, is an experience that is not just known to people who are addicted, right? Again, the seeking of pleasure or the experience of pleasure and the desire not to be in pain is fundamental to human beings. I mean, you know, the entrance, the Bodhisattva way says what? I mean, that's in our practice of the four measures. Everybody wants to be happy. Pleasure. Nobody wants to suffer. Pain. Right? I mean, it's the same paradigm. Right? People want to be happy. People don't want to suffer. And drugs, alcohol, shopping, sex, et cetera, et cetera. You know, zooming out on the internet and just, you know, keeping yourself stimulated that way. These are pleasure events. And the more one's life is oriented toward consuming those pleasurable experiences, the less we have to really deal with what's going on inside us. Or what's going on inside our family members and our colleagues and our society. As bodhisattvas, we want to be able to be there for others. And one of the best ways we can be there for others is demonstrating in our life that one can be happy and have pleasure in one's life without the need of consuming something. You know, anytime I need to consume something to get a feeling, you know, I am entering into the world of what? Delusion. Because I am not acknowledging that I have that capacity. I have that capacity already in me. But many of us are lazy too. It's like, you know, I think that's part of it too, the availability. It's these things are so available, so I can understand why the legalization of drugs and all that from a legal jailing people certainly makes sense. I can understand that. In a certain sense, that's good. You know, why lock up people, you know, who are in pain and are seeking pleasure or an absence of pain? Yeah, I can understand that. But yet we have to stop and go, all right, so now drugs and alcohol and cannabis and everything is widely available. Anybody can just get down the corner. But you know, see, I'm talking about it from a different perspective. What is that, you know, what is that saying to people? I think I remember, I could be confused, but I think I remember when the COVID thing first started, way back when, and I think in the state of Colorado, they when they were talking about, you know, things to keep open, I think they wanted to close down the the cannabis shops and the liquor stores, and there was an uproar, and not before that there was an uproar, but so many people were lined up in front of these stores because they're thinking they're closed. They felt it was being unsafe. You know, I think those were the days before everybody wore a mask. I mean, it's just indicative of our society. Yes, but let's move on.
The precept on sexuality says no sex without a long-term commitment, but this can be challenging while dating and determining compatibility.
Yeah, so this is interesting. I'll just be open. There has been a process. I mean, and that's in the Thich Nhat Hanh mindfulness trainings, in the Thich Nhat Hanh. That's not other Buddhist, that's not in other Buddhist precepts, in other Buddhist traditions, even in the Zen tradition. That's something that's been developed in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition. And in the earlier versions of the mindfulness trainings, that was not there. The caution about sexuality, et cetera, was always there. And the idea about sexual abuse and stuff like that, using it to harm others. Yeah, I don't propagate that one. I think in the later version it even goes on, not only do you need to be in a long-term loving relationship with a long-term commitment, but if you're going to have a sexual relationship, you're supposed to you're supposed to publicly announce it, sort of. To me that's such a bizarre thing. I mean, it's like only somebody who's not in touch with culture, especially young people's culture, would think of, you know. So I'll just be very honest. That's my take. And yet, the idea that, and again, I don't know. You know, sex is a pleasurable experience. Can two people get together without a long-term commitment or any kind of love and have a pleasurable experience? I think if we were just bodies, that would be possible. I think for animals, that's probably very possible. But we are human beings, we're more complex. It's not just pleasure we're seeking. Many people are seeking relationship. They're seeking connection. I mean, I used to work with lots of people and, that's when you got under it, that's what they wanted. Or they wanted release from their pain, from their tension, and they found that having sex was doing that. I mean, it's the idea that somehow it's just this totally benign experience outside of the conditioning of the human being and the needs and the wants of the human being, I think, is foolhardy. Again, if somebody I'm certainly not here to judge anybody. In the end of the day, we all have to judge ourselves. I think one has to just take a deep look, at one's own sexual history. Is that true? That one can have all the sex they want with anybody they want, and it's no price to pay. I don't know if that's true. I don't think it is. That's not been my experience. Because human beings attach. Human beings have needs. We're not animals. We understand that the sexual imperative is sort of animalistic. It has to do with, the procreation of the species. There's a reason why there are a lot of pleasure centers around those organs that have to do with procreation, the reproduction of the species. Nature wants animals to do it. And, pleasure seeking is a good way to, to get people to exercise that. But, we are, as a society, we are so far beyond, sex for reproductive purposes, that we have to be very honest about having detached those two and having made sexuality unto a thing unto itself. I mean, why the mass consumption of pornography? Right? I'm just guessing, but it has to do that somehow just the direct physical relationship with another human being or another body or one's own body is not enough, you see. We need more stimulation, stimulation, stimulation. Why is that? Right? What is the mind state for the person who consumes it? What is the mind state before you get on the computer to do that? I mean, stop. What am I feeling now? What is it that I need? What is it that I want to get away from? You see, as practitioners, we have to be willing to be courageous to just do the simple thing of looking directly at ourselves and our minds with this deep looking of inquiry, you know, what's really going on with me? What is motivating me? And that's, you know, that's self-awareness. That's knowing oneself. So, yes.
How do we approach others in our lives with this perspective without coming across as judgmental?
Yeah, so again, I don't make it a big deal, you see. This is just me, right? You know, I mean, it's like, I don't drink, right? I don't smoke. I don't tell other people they can't. I mean, when I'm at family gatherings where people are doing that, you know, I don't say anything. I don't look askance at anybody. I don't, you know, I just don't. But through my actions, you know, they know where I'm at. You know, sometimes at family gatherings, when it's my house, you know, they have to bring their own stuff because, you know, I don't serve it. Because I don't want to support that. But I don't, you know, I mean, the same way when they come to my house, I don't serve meat or fish or anything, you know. I mean, we're vegan. But, you know, I don't force anybody. If people are interested in why I don't use substances, I'm very happy to tell them. But I'm not here to evangelize or make people feel uncomfortable. So I mean, I don't deal with family members in that way, you know. But also, you know, if I'm at a family gathering, you know, where, you know, and if you're at family gatherings where as time goes on and people have drunk more, it gets looser, you know, I'll often just, good night, everyone. Enjoy yourselves, you know, just because a lot of times, you know, it, you know, I remember when I used to deal with alcoholics years ago, you know, and they talk about, you know, after they were sober a while, you know, they go back to their bar to visit their old buddies or visit old friends, and they say, wow, they're, you know, it's really kind of stupid. Well, no, it's, or they somehow feel like somehow that since they've left, the conversations have gotten just stupider or something. I said, no, it always is that way. You were just intoxicated. You know, I mean, your frontal cortex was a little anesthetized. You know, that was, you know, you thought it was all brilliant. Right? Everybody's having fun, right? Fun. Yeah, I mean, so sometimes you just have to, you know, do that. I don't know if there's more there to that. I mean, I think, again, we don't have to be judgmental. We don't have to, you know, put people down or preach to them or sermonize to them. But just in our behavior, in a very relaxed way, you know, we have our values. We live our life. We're not trying to impose it on anybody else. But also, we don't have to participate in things that really go against our values or our, you know, valueless experiences. So anyhow, that's how I do it.
My issue is about food, which is less talked about but prevalent in our society.
Mm-hmm.
I see myself grasping for food mindlessly. Eating mindfully is something I find myself resisting.
Yeah, again, I think, you know, I mean, I think this is one of the tragedies of our society that we, you know, have moved on, you know, from, you know, when I began as a mental health person, you know, it was drug and alcohol. I mean, that's what the addictions were about. And then over time, sexual addiction all of a sudden developed. And then food addictions. And food and eating disorders, you know, I mean, so, and shopping, and now internet, and again, when I was getting out of the field, I was beginning to have a couple of patients but also people who would talk about, you know, pornography addiction. So again, we have this capacity, unfortunately, to just ramp up our consumption of pleasurable experiences, which again, the more we do them, we get less pleasure, so we do have to do them more and more. I mean, that is the spiral. I mean, the Buddha and Buddhist psychology talked about this 2,600 years ago, the diminishing returns of pleasure, right? And that the pursuit of it, that the thirst, the grasping, the attaching, is a source of suffering and agitation. So therefore the Buddha, you know, for a certain group of people, like his monks and nuns, it was like, no. No sex, no consumption. I mean, that was kind of the simplest way. No shopping, no money, no, you know, just no. Right? That whole, I mean, it doesn't mean they don't have to probably still deal with it, but it's you're not actively involved in it, so you're not actively feeding the tanha, feeding the thirst, feeding the craving. So, you know, now food, right? I mean, you know, as compared to the other things like sex and drugs, alcohol and shopping, you know what I mean? Like food is like, you know, everybody, you have to do it. So, you know, and food is about what? Food is about the health and well-being of our body. And yet, food, because it has to deal with sense organs, sight, smell, taste, becomes a sensual experience, right? And therefore, the more one is focused on those things, because, you know, sensual experience have positive and negative context, you know, all of a sudden it is about what? The pursuit of pleasure, right? You know, you go to restaurants, it's all about presentation, pleasure to the eyes. You haven't even, doesn't matter how it tastes. You see, it's giving us visual pleasure. We come out with food that looks, you know, people go, ooh, very pleasurable, right? Smell, very pleasurable. Taste, very pleasurable, right? You see? So it is about taking something which is normal and turning it into this pursuit of pleasure, obsession, right? About. But again, it keeps raising the bar. It keeps raising the bar. That's why now, you know, there are magazines all about food. There are TV stations all about food. There are probably a million internet programs all about food. Food, 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 food. More beautiful, more pleasure, you know, more cookbooks. Like for what? For what? What happened to simplicity? You know, what happened to simple enjoyment of simple food, pleasure? I mean, that's pleasurable. And again, I'm not saying that making nicer meals, you know, for special, you know what I mean? But it's what the question is, how does it become obsessive, addictive, and the pursuit of pleasure? Because what's the other side, you see? And now you're talking about, you know, maybe what this person's talking about, food. Food is pleasurable. As long as we're eating it. It's very short term, but it is pleasurable. And therefore, it is the answer to mind states that are not pleasurable. Bored, unpleasurable, go eat something pleasurable. Unhappy, negative mind state, go eat something pleasurable, right? Sad, lonely, go eat something pleasurable. Can you see? You're talking about emotional needs that are real. You're talking about afflictive mind states that are painful. And our response is to give our body momentary pleasure, which only lasts as long as the experience. So again, this person says, it's hard to do it, I know, because we have to be willing to stop. This comes back to our whole fundamental practice of mindfulness of feelings. You know, am I willing to stop and just be present to whatever I'm feeling, experiencing, and learn to take care of that myself? How empowering. How unempowering to think I get, you know, like the kitchen is the source of everything, right? Want to reward myself, eat. Bored, eat. Sad, eat. Lonely, eat. You know, everything but what it should be, which is hungry, eat. I mean, that's the natural conditioner for eating. I'm hungry. But so many people, you know, well, I have a need for a little sweet. I mean, people talk about this, it's like, oh, that's interesting. I mean, is it your tongue that has the need? I mean, what has a need for sweets right now? It's the mind seeking pleasure because it's not in a pleasurable state. We have to acknowledge that. Now, again, I understand because of the repetitive of behaviors, the repetitive of mind states, that after a while, these things have a life of their own, so we don't even think. We just kind of, yeah, we just could naturally put things in our mouth. We're not even in touch with. Yeah, things become habitual, things become addictive. And we just kind of keep repeating the cycle unconsciously. Mindfulness is becoming conscious. It's part of our whole process of waking up. Waking up in this present moment and being present to what's really going on with me. Not just simply I have a desire that moves me towards something, but I'm actually, at a deeper level, having an aversion to something that I'm experiencing. And some people, again, it's when the music stops, you see. It's like when there's nothing going on. Even for just a few minutes, we want to fill it up. Because just even being alone with ourselves is uncomfortable. And the only way we know that, if we're willing to stop and be alone with ourselves and experience what that's like and acknowledge, yeah. When the stimulation stops, when the activity stops, when there's nothing to do, and I'm just here, that's not comfortable and relaxed, right? And we're not even willing to stay there a while to be present to it and learn how to transform it, we right away, because again, we have so much, you see. We have a society and an economy that has just given us endless ways of giving ourselves momentary pleasure, momentary stimulation. It's very difficult for people. So my answer to that woman, yeah, I understand. But you know what? It is because we suffer that we want to change. You know? If we're not willing to be present to what's really going on within us, to feel it, to name it as suffering, and to really say to oneself, yeah, I am sick of short-term, meaningless, you know, choices in my life to deal with my own suffering. But again, it's not even like it's that benign, because, you know, being overweight is like pervasive in our society, and it has significant health concerns. Diabetes, I mean, there's all kinds of, you know, these are, it's not just normal. See, it is harmful. And again, in the way we eat and the things we serve, it's just like with the alcohol. To me, I am making a statement to my children, to my family, about how to live healthily. Not telling them what to do. Because I care about them. Because I don't want them to have so many of these lifestyle disorders of heart disease and stroke and diabetes, you know, so many of these things that are just lifestyle choices. So again, it's very empowering for all of us to sit in a place where we can look at ourselves, look at our life, and make choices that are not only a benefit for ourselves, but for the benefit of those we love and care about in our society. You know, that is the one thing that we can do. Each of us can do. We can't wait for others. Yes, Bill. And anybody in here want to chime in, please?
It seems important to make a distinction between pleasure and true happiness. Can you comment or elaborate on that?
Well, I think that's what I've been talking about. And again, we have to be careful with true happiness. It sounds so big, you know, capital T, capital H. Yeah, pleasure is sensual. It is the nature of our senses, including our thinking mind. You know, this is fundamental Buddhist psychology. All contact with phenomena is either positive, negative, or neutral. Positive, it means, is pleasurable. And then there are more, you know, intensities of pleasure. So, So the thing about these kinds of happinesses is they are impermanent and short-term. You know, being with friends, pleasurable. But it's short term. It's dependent on the experience. And of course, it's not always pleasurable. Being with family can be pleasurable. After a few days, it could be unpleasurable. You know, I mean, it's all this takes part in the world of change and permanence, things becoming. So a true happiness means a happiness in Buddhism means a happiness that is not dependent on external circumstances. That's a true happiness. A false happiness is a happiness that's dependent on other things, you see. And that's very important because again, you know, we want to be free. Free means I can say yes, I can say no. I remember when I used to deal with you know, it's very common with people who have drug and alcohol problems is their response is, I don't have a problem. You know, I could stop at any time, but I enjoy it. I don't want to. It's not a problem. But, you know, and oftentimes they say, but, you know, but your wife thinks it's a problem or your kids think it's a problem. It sounds like your boss thinks it's a problem, you know. So, you know, I agree with you. It's really no problem and you're in control. So why don't you just stop for a month and see what that's like? They look at you. You know, it's like, well, if it's no problem, then why, you know, or if somebody says to me, well, you know, I mean, I have a glass or two of wine a day. It's really no problem for me. I mean, all right. Well, why don't you just stop it and really see if that's true? Oh, I can't do that. Well, that's indicative of something. If we're free, we're free. As I say, when I'm with my family, am I free to have a glass of wine or a beer with them? Yes, I am. But I choose not to, not because I think I'm going to go crazy or get intoxicated or, you know, one is because I just don't need it. I mean, I actually feel better, clearer, more connected with people without it. You know? yeah, it's like that. So, yeah. Anything else, Bill? Okay.
So these are two questions. So the first is, can you talk about if one feels inspired by this, but then when craving arises, how do you deal with it? Everywhere you turn, there's ads trying to lure the mind away.
Yeah.
And the second piece is, what practice do you recommend when craving for any of these pleasurable experiences arises? Can the transformation of these cravings and acting upon them become part of our practice?
Yeah, so that's, again, whether, one's really, in trouble in terms of the use of intoxicants or sexuality or all these various things, or whether it's just kind of part of your life and it's not all that significant, but one looks at it in this way, one goes, yeah, it is, there is a lot of craving and attachment and thirsting So craving. First step is to, go through this reflective process that I've tried to do with you today, where you're willing to inwardly be present and mindful of every time you feel the mind moving towards something, and in beginning to grasp, thirst. Tanha. Thirst means what? I'm thirsty. I'm missing something. I want something. Watch the mind. And when you see craving arise, name it. I am aware that there's craving. Arise in me. Now, what I would suggest you do next is go the opposite way. What was I feeling before the craving, the needing? You see, this is how we unpack it and not just impose, the anti-craving program. I mean, some people need the anti-craving program because they're highly addicted and they just need stop, But if you're not there yet, and then you go into rehab and you do all those things. But if you're not there yet and it's something you can deal with yourself, to me, I go the other way. What's going on? You see? What am I feeling? What's my mind state? Out of which this craving for something over there is arising. What do I need? Do I really need this? Will my life really be better? I mean, one can reflect. What am I going to get? Angie's interested in getting a new, personal disclosure, getting a new sofa for us. One's 20 or 30 years old. It was just interesting. So we went to a store, nothing negative, called Crate and Barrel, maybe you all know that. I walked in and I thought, wow, this whole place is just set up for craving. And there are all these nice people there to help you. What are you craving for today? Of course, they don't say that. Yeah, but you realize, you walk in there and everything is what? Nice. All these beautiful objects. Things you never even thought you needed, all of a sudden you could need, right? And you got very excited about a chair. So. I mean, there it is. In Buddhist thought, this human realm is considered the world of desire. That's not a negative. That's just a description. Right? It's just, there it is. The human mind endlessly desiring. But to be caught in the cycle of desiring is not freedom. It is the path of suffering, because desire leads to craving, to wanting, to needing, to attaching, to grasping, and that's where suffering arises. So if you ask me, step one, understand what craving is within you. Two, be mindful of it and name it when it arises. Three, what is the mind state that is causing you to crave. What are you feeling? Could just be mild anxiety, mild just feeling not right. You know, it could be just boredom. I mean, it doesn't have to be anything of significance, but you realize there is a quality to our mind that is underneath this movement toward needing something. So I would say at that point is, how do I take care of that afflictive emotion? Because if you don't take care of it and you're always working on the craving side of, you know, reining that part of you in, the cause of it will always be there. So to me it's you know, the Buddhist path is the, you know, it's really the Four Noble Truths. Suffering, cause of suffering. You uproot the cause of suffering. And then, of course, this is as important is, you know, so what do I do, you see? Okay, if I don't, you know, pour that glass of wine today, what do I do? You have to do something that gives you a sense of stability, of ease, you know? Yeah, I mean, when I was talking to somebody this week and they were talking about, you know, that I don't know if they smoke pot or what they do, but they said it's a social thing. It makes me more relaxed. It makes me a little more loquacious, you know? Oftentimes I don't feel like a part of things. And when I have a little, you know, intoxicant in me, I can, yeah. I said, well, yeah, it's, and I mean, basically what I said to this person was, you know, you weren't born this way. You didn't, you know, this is a trait that you learned and it's been reinforced for decades. You can learn how to connect with people. I mean, this is not, you know, you don't need a PhD in human relations. I mean, you can learn how to connect with people. And it'll feel much better to know that you're learning how to connect to people, learning how to talk with people, learning how to share with people, learning. I mean, we can learn these things, right? So, you know, it's very important, again, that we also develop, you know, or somebody says, well, you know, I like having a glass of wine when I'm preparing food. Well, you know, I made dinner last night, very pleasurable. You know, just being there, present, cooking the food, smelling, tasting. You know, I mean, you know, what more do I need? So I think it's very important that, again, this practice where we're learning not just, you know, I mean, we're not just learning not to suffer, we're learning how to be happy. Okay. We're learning that we don't need a drug to diminish the sense of separation and alienation and disconnection that many of us experience. That through the practice of learning how to be present too, we can learn how to connect. By learning how to diminish the sense of self, we can get the barriers to connection out of the way. I mean, this is the practice we do. Anyhow, I thank you all. I hope this has been stimulating and very free. And please, you know, any of you who are my students and want to talk to me about this, I'm certainly open. I mean, as I said, the fact that nobody talks to me about this, I just hope it's not me. Thank you, everyone.